said, I'm going to bang twice. Okay.
Yeah. And right, great.
See how it all comes out
just,
in the wash.
Just give it a bang.
Hello, I'm John Anthony.
And I'm Jason Fox.
And you're listening to Kindred Spirits, where you don't need to love anything, because Jason and I will love it for you.
Love that for you!
that's great. That comes up, you know, I'm triggered by that. Like, I love that for you.
And, oh, man. You know, and it's funny because I decided to slide that in as the intro because now we can tell loyal listeners that episode 9, this one, is the return of the fake ad.
Oh, I love that for you.
Well, you don't love it for you.
No, I love it. I love it. I love it. I missed it. Oh, I felt like this is so good. This heals the wound. Like, I felt like such a prick. Like, ever since I was like, can we just ditch the thing that everyone loves that I love too? So, and for the sake of efficiency, right? but well, hey.
But mate, the whole thing is an experiment. One of my favorites, it was around EP4 when I said, don't forget the chair spin. And you were like, have we moved beyond the spin? And I was like, yeah.
but people weren't writing and saying, love the chair spin.
Bring back the spin.
Maybe someone will this time. Maybe someone will say, I've really missed listening to the spin.
Yeah, I enjoyed the squeaky sound of your chair as you correct your ergonomics. No. Yeah, so you know what? It's an experiment. And so you shave things off. Listeners go, hey, bring that back. And we do. We need to stay responsive.
Yes, and beware the perils of audience capture, right? I don't know if it's the fox in me that eschews capture, but have you read that article, by the way, The Perils of Audience Capture?
Fizz, even before we talk about this article, you just did something crazy synchro destiny, okay? So you just said yes and without even knowing it, that's the fake ad, dude. The whole fake ad is yes and. What have you done, synchro destiny? Yeah. Hold on. Sorry, back to the perils. What were you saying?
Well, there's another thread that you've opened up already that I want to chat with you about. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like mm-hmm. yes and, but it's like more both and. But the perils of audience capture, this is where you do things, the audience responds, and so you're like, oh, the audience liked that, so you double down on that. And then progressively the audience feedback and the algo and all this stuff, you end up veering so far from what you want to do that, yeah, sure, you've converted yourself to what the audience wants, but is it what you want? Is it what keeps you alive? And so the example used in this article, The Perils of Audience Capture, was this kid that started like YouTube videos eating things, and then just over time he just ate more and more stuff and just became obese. And yeah, it's like,
oh man, that's rugged.
It's rugged. So hopefully our audience loves us and only wants the best for us.
But that one's so symbolic and sad, isn't it? Like this person who's feeding themselves and feeding on the attention and hurting themselves, and a diet of mining people's eyeballs, and then what that does to them, you know, physically, spiritually, psychologically, aesthetically. Crikey, that's unnerving.
Yeah, and I reckon it happens on many subtle levels. I'm going to give you an example. I was so inspired by you. You said a week or two ago, like, time to like hop off LinkedIn for a bit because so we can dodge all the South by Southwest updates. I accidentally saw one from a dear friend of ours. I shan't name her, but you know, it was a good one. It was very neutral, but it was the comment that really rattled me, right? So this is part of like a bigger context on the second day of South by Southwest. Then there ended up being a very fun talk about podcasting in 2025 with the excellent title of How to Make Podcasts That Aren't Extremely Boring. How to Make Podcasts That Aren't Extremely Boring. I enjoyed the strong views about putting the fluff, the hellos, and the side chat at the end or in a whole other episode. Get people to the good stuff immediately, all caps. as in, you don't need to warm up your audience. You don't need to ask your guest how they are, etc.
I mean, I've got a lot to say already, but the most ironic thing about what you've just read is that if you're supposed to save side chat until the end, our whole goddamn podcast is side chat. That's what this is.
It's baffling. It's just baffling, right? And then someone else who is a friend, I don't think they listen to this, but they're like full agreement, like just give us the good stuff immediately. And the reason I'm like so rattled by this is I've been reading this book, Against the Machine.
Oh, now I've seen that. That must be okay. Please tell us more about this book.
Well, I mean, I haven't gotten far into it, and the style in the initial bits is like I'm still warming to some of the pieces. But this whole...
Love the art, man. The art
is your great. Mate
Simon. You know your so friend good. From Europe, Simon, who you've interviewed?
Yeah. Simon Dunderles.
Yes, totally. He loves that old school sci-fi artwork. Sorry, tell us more about the book.
Well,
first.
There's this thing, right? You and I will relate to this. The Machine, Moloch, the God of Coordination, Failure, Child Sacrifice, Perverse Incentives, the Great Devourer, this... quest towards optimizing to becoming ever more efficient parts of the machine, well-oiled, efficient, optimized, reduced, and all this stuff. That is what I am, and you and I are both railing against. And I just feel that this slide towards efficiency of AI summaries, give me the AI summary, I don't have time to read the book, or give me the frictionless kind of, you know, just give me the answers immediately. I'm like, fuck that. No, stay in the quest. Like, part of being on a quest is all the friction, all the non-linearity, the kind of unexpected serendipitous turns. And
that's
and
right. So, the pauses, the breaths, the side paths, the unpredicted elements, the nature, the waves, the wind, the creatures that arrive unprompted. You know, man, you know, as you're getting into it, the first thing that occurred to me is stop ruining shit with rules. Like, you're fucking it up with your rules.
Machines love rules.
If I'm about to start a podcast and then I read some shitful map from some podcast guru and they say to me, oh, hurry the fuck up and get to the good stuff. Well, what does that even mean? And now I'm preoccupied with what is the good stuff, right? And so in the process of trying to fast forward to what I've decided is good, I've deleted all this shit that may have happened. What have I sacrificed on the altar of someone else's shitful roadmap? Honestly, man. And, you know, it's funny. You would have seen this, but, like, when people come out of the woodwork for me and they tell me what they love about a certain episode, often they'll flashback shit that I don't even remember. You know, like, our lovely friend Leanne said to me the other day, oh, J.A., I really want to stop at the tavern. And when she said that to me, I was like, wow, that sounds fucking awesome. What's she talking about, right? And then I had to go back and listen to an episode where you and I spoke about stopping at the tavern. And I love that Leanne loved that because I forgot about it, man.
I mean, imagine
if this is what we're both saying. Imagine if we got so preoccupied with what's supposed to make a fucking inverted commas good episode that we predetermine that the stop at the tavern bit isn't the good stuff. And so we don't say it. What are we doing? You don't know.
Yeah. Now we need to cut the fluff, you know, get straight to the point. Oh, it is the opposite of warmth, of conviviality, of serendipity, of emergence. Instead, it's like cold, analytical, like artificial distilled. I just don't like it. And so hence seeing that and just reminding, like, this is the trajectory the world is going on.
Yeah, man.
What are they missing? Like, the joys of the detour.
And that's the sickening thing that we're landing on here is it's people in it for the wrong reasons. If you're in it for eyeballs and eardrums, then you already fucked it. Stop it.
Yeah.
There's something so grubby about your approach from inception.
And there's a parallel here, and this might be like my PhD was on goal setting amongst, you know, other things. And this is where I learned this whole thing of, like, if you set a goal into the future, you're kind of like, you're focused and you're narrowed focused. And so that you're less likely to explore the tangential paths along the way. And the tragedy is often you achieve your goal, but you don't know what you've missed along the way. And I don't know, there's something about going into like a podcast to become, you know, to get reach, to get the numbers and all these other things. And you're right, it just corrupts and it deviates you from the magic of what is happening right now.
On the money. All right, two things. Oh, there's so many things, Fizz. You've
yeah, man.
My brain is constantly buzzing whenever you start talking. But one thing that hit me quickly was there was this period where I was mixed up with a bunch of musicians. Do you remember a band called The Preachers? They blew up for a while. They were a cool band, and my brother was mates with the bass player, and one of my friends, Tim, was friends with Izzy, the lead singer. But there's this thing that artists do where, you know, they'll have a hit and then their label is essentially asking them to write the same song again, you know? So they go back into the studio and their hit was a song called Is This How You Feel? And they kept producing all this new music that sounded different from that, but the label's like, no, bring us another Is This How You Feel? And they're kind of there going, but I don't want to write the same goddamn song, right? But the label needs them to because it's turned into money. It's turned into, you know, listenership and hits and all the rest of it. And so there's this wave, there's this period where artists are writing songs, particularly in the Australian market, which couldn't be more limiting, because as an independent Aussie musician, unless you crack Triple J, you're fucked, right? There's no underground success routes here. In places like the States, they have college radio and other ways to come up as an independent, but in essence, in Oz, unless you're on Triple J, you're a nobody. But then what you have is artists writing songs not from their soul, you know, not from who it is they are and the lens that they see the world through, but it does this sound like a Triple J song? You know, will this get on Triple J? And just think about what that's doing to creativity. It's just massacring people's instincts. I'll never forget this interview with Frank Zappa, right? You know Zappa, really cooked guitarist? Like he's so innovative and strange, and he sounds like no one but Frank Zappa. But I remember seeing him interviewed years ago, and he said one of the best things about when I came up as a musician was the people at the top of record labels didn't know anything about music, right? So you had all these like kind of A&R exec cats who didn't know what good music was. So you could bring them the most cooked out experimental garbage and they go, I don't know, maybe the kids will listen to it. And they'd release it, right? They release it. But these days there's all these like hipsters at the top of the chain curating what's cool. Oh, that's hip, that's not, that's weird, that's buckled. And so people aren't writing songs from their heart. They're writing songs for what they think a song is supposed to be so that it makes it onto the fucking radio. That's a glitch, man. That's a harrowing glitch.
Similar thing happening, like looking at what's going on with Substack with like the writing platforms. They got like leaderboards of who's rising and so on. Similar for YouTube is like, I forget his name, the person who does lots of YouTube videos, is like experimental, like having a thumbnail where you're looking shocked or something like that is 10% more effective. Yeah. So then everyone's like fucking doing that and so on. It's just this kind of, I don't know, this there's this like cacophony pantomime, and part of me just seeks like what's going on outside of this cacophony, you know, by the river next to the forest. And that's
adjacent to the tavern. What's the
And you know, I've been very light on social media for the past month or so, and I've felt like I've been able to hear my own voice again once more. Like I felt connected to the muse once more, and I love it. And I don't know quite what to do, because just before we're on air, we're talking about how there's part of our job means that we do need to show up. Like we need to bring the fruits of the other world into the middle world. Like we can't just hoard it for ourselves. Part of the oscillatory nature of trickster kindred spirits is to kind of be of both worlds. But yeah, it's nice to have a break from the mainstream world and social media.
A deliberate signing out. You know, I think you just saw it. I did one where I spoke about, and I never pronounce it nicely. Oh, Shinrin Yoku. Shinrin Yoku.
Yeah. Right? I love how you put a slight Japanese accent on that.
Thank you.
That was a lovely video. I love the transition, and then suddenly you're there. Like,
you know, I'll tell you the funniest thing about that video. I had to shoot it backwards. You know, I was in the forest first, so I had to shoot the video out of sequence. But the best thing about it is that if you listen really closely, when I'm in the forest and I'm talking about how tranquil it is, an aeroplane comes over me.
Oh, yeah.
totally ruins the vibe. And so I had to cut in nature sounds as part of the edit. Like I felt like a real charlatan,
it's the equivalent to a motivational speaker, like cutting in like stock audience applause sounds.
Yes. I love that. You know, I often feel guilt about that because I've got a show reel where the MC was a morning television host. I'm trying to think of his name. He's a funny cat. Carl? Is that ringing a bell with you? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Some funny dude. But I was at an event once where he was the MC. And so there's footage of me on stage and him on stage. And there's a couple of cutaways where people are laughing. And I think, oh, they're not laughing at me. They're laughing at the other guy. I'm a liar, right? I'm a liar. Sometimes they're laughing at me, Fizz. God.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an art to doing that with like a knowingness. Yeah.
Exactly.
Anywho,
exactly.
This has been a lovely little tangent. Thanks for you're one of the few people I could bring up my vexation. Can I just add one more thing? I did a podcast with this lovely person, and I realize I take for granted that you and I can dance in Emergence quite well, you know, no prep and stuff like that. So I was just used to that. And I was like, here we are. We jumped on Riverside and I was like, cool. Are you okay if I just hit the record button? You can see everything afterwards. And if there's anything we can cut out. Yeah. And she was like, oh shit. And I was like, okay. And then I spent the next 20 minutes, just, you know, making things comfy and nice for us. It was a beautiful conversation, wide ranging. We talked over time. It was like, you know, you can tell it's good because you have a slight authenticity hangover afterwards. You're like, oh, yes. Shit, did I kind of reveal too much? Was I too human and relatable? and then with Riverside, she was 99% uploaded. And I was like, it should be all right. Just make sure you leave your computer on. Anyway, her computer went to sleep. We haven't been able to salvage the files.
Oh, you lost the episode, Fizz.
But that's okay. We lost the episode. She says, that's okay, actually. I was feeling a bit uncomfortable about it. Next time we can do it with a bit more clarity and focus. And I was like,
what does that mean?
Yes. What does that mean? This is the same parrot. And I accept that maybe this is more of an advanced maneuver that you and I are pulling off here. And I can understand when folks, you know, don't necessarily have the same podcast or the same kind of experience. They haven't maybe accrued the same jadedness for the scripted or the focus of the clear and stuff like that. But it left me feeling like, oh, how do I do this? How do we introduce other people? How do we gently usher them into the dance of Emergence, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, it's built on their previous experience and their old paradigm. You know, if you've guested several times or if you've listened to several types, then you have a format in your mind of how you think it's supposed to go. And so that's why I always talk about trying to be delightfully disruptive by design. You know, you can't just be disruptive. You've got to do it in a way that tickles, right? But if you're pushing them so far away, you know, from their growth edge and they're just uncomfortable, you know how it works, man. Then you're putting all of your cognitions into saving face or even worse, defending or fighting back. And no one's resourced to listen. So even your questions, they're already two steps in front of themselves, and creativity gets mauled in those conditions as well.
There is certainly something to be said about, you know, in those conditions where, because you'll probably have this in terms of when you're speaking to an audience and you're maybe inviting some participation and stuff like that, it's really important to model vulnerability yourself, not in a performed way, but in a kind of genuine.
Yeah,
I don't know everything, because that gives an implicit permission for others to not have it all completely figured out. But if you're the kind of smooth, polished, charismatic, everything's perfect, people are going to respond like that too and just bring their, you know, manufactured selves to the mix.
You called it. And, you know, I think two tricks that we pull very quickly is self-ironic humor. Like I usually find a way to knock myself down in the intro. I might poke fun at how I've got how I need a haircut or something silly like that. But early on, any signal that you can show them that you don't take yourself too seriously, I think is really powerful. So self-ironic humor for the win. But the other thing that I've been doing a lot in the last 2 years, Fizz, is I constantly keep trying to remind people that all we are is in the exchange of ideas. You know, so I'll say to people, none of this is the gospel. I'm not telling anyone what to do. None of us are here to say what's right and what's wrong. And so a lovely term, and I think I got this from my mate Arthur Papajamas at AP Psychology in South Yarra, but you talk about the idea that anything you're trying to help each other with is just them adding new items onto their ever-expanding menu of interventions. That's it. You know, so when you're doing leadership training or trying to help people to empower others, you say, hey, here's a whole bunch of ideas, but you're just expanding your own menu of interventions, which means that the thicker or fatter your menu, the more likely it is that you can serve up an idea that is to someone's taste. If they enjoy it, you stay on that trajectory. If it pisses them off or it triggers them, just abandon it. Just stop and do something else. You know, I always find that funny. Oh, sorry, go ahead, legend.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there. There's the thing of enhancing the repertoire, you know, the toolkit. I find there's a distinction that a lot of clients that I'm working with aren't as attuned to, that this is really important, the distinction between skills and sensibilities.
Mm.
So one thing is to learn more skills, have more skills in the toolkit. The other is to cultivate the sensibility of knowing which skill to use at which point in time, to have that situational savvy, to be like, actually, you know what? Now is not the time for some sort of, you know, heavy-handed blah, or now's not the time to kind of do this maneuver. This person just needs me to be present and listen, or, you know, whatever it is. And the sensibility is harder to box up and package up, but it's the difference between, you know, the clumsy utilization of a freshly learnt skill and the sensibility to be like, you know what? They know more than me in this instance. I'm just going to be with them. Yeah.
And when you talk about it, I'm thinking of instinct, you know, there was a part of me that wants to say you can't teach instinct, but I don't know if that's true. That's like when people say you can't teach emotional intelligence. I mean, you can certainly help to create more awareness, you know? So
yeah.
You know, is instinct a thing that can be taught? Yes, if you're doing it by helping people to become more aware. You know, that quote is creepy. Go ahead, legend.
No, go. I'm just so fascinated by this.
It's a quote that I think I've snuck into the podcast before because it's great. Anthony DeMello, he used to say, what you're aware of, you're in control of. What you're not aware of is in control of you. So let's talk about instinct. What were you going to say?
I always get like, whenever someone says the word control, I'm like, oh, really? You think you're in control?
Because you're saying, well, are you really in control?
Yeah, it's an illusion. Yeah. Because I think there is something about like the surrendered like awareness. Like it's not so much control, which always evokes for me like a kind of a grip. Like people love control because they fear the you know, what happens when I'm not in control. But there's a surrenderedness, and even though you're not in control, you still have an awareness and a situational awareness, which means that you can update your, you know, disposition, however, enables you to dance within the context that you're in. So it might not be control.
Yeah, and maybe in the process enhance your instincts. I like that you've taken objection to the word control. I'll give you an example that I love getting into, helping people to quickly understand and then carve out the difference between a reaction and a response. You know, they're definitely not the same thing. And so I think bringing awareness in that kind of context is useful, you know? And so it is a thing. That's true. I think you can help people enhance their instincts. And why
I really
would you
like,
want to get better at that?
I do think so, but it's different from teaching in the conventional sense. This is where the trickster teacher is better, because the trickster teacher creates the conditions in which, if we can combine entropy as well as the integrative support, people have the experience of entropy, they realize how they react rather than respond, and then you've got a container in which you can unpack that, you know?
Beautiful.
But with this reaction thing, I love the concept of allergies, where we have an inflated negative response to something and as a reactive experience. So sometimes people have an allergy to the word woke or feminism or nationalism
or Donald
Trump or control. Exactly. It's like
allergy. I love that, man.
But everyone cultivating awareness of their own allergies, it's like a sense of like, oh, look, I can't help but sneezing in these contexts or when someone says control or blah, 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 or you need to kind of, you know, cut the fluff out of your podcast. I have a reaction immediately and it's not quite response. It's not the cool kind of measured, you know, witty, you know, wily, sagacious, you know, response. It's me spurting out something. But an awareness of the allergies and our reactions does allow us to at least catch ourselves in the act of reacting and then ameliorate. Yes. And yeah.
That's exactly it. And one of my favorite things that surfaced when I studied cognitive behavioral therapy is when you can feel that bubbling. So let's go with it. When you can feel the tickle in the snout and you're on the precipice of the sneeze, right? You say to yourself, does this look or feel like something from the past? Yeah. It's one of the best questions you can ask, because very quickly you work out what it is. And then once you realize what it's reminding you about, you can delete the trigger, right?
Yeah.
And then make an informed decision about what behavior bubbles to the surface. You know, this is the one of the ways through it. And I think it's fantastic. I'll never forget, I was with one of my FMCG clients a few years ago. And before the session, 30 seconds before the session started, they handed me my facilitator guide. Have you ever seen one of these?
It's been a long time.
You know, so little postage stamp thumbnails of each of the slides, but then next to it, what you're supposed to say.
Oh, fuck that.
Right? So click the first slide.
Oh,
good
Jesus
morning,
Christ.
Everybody. Yeah. You know, click the second slide, yeah. Do the acknowledgement of country. And so yeah. we both know what I did with it, Fizz, right? Like I threw it behind myself, rocked the sesh. Session wraps. This person waits for everyone to leave the room and then comes up to me and says, John, why is it that you failed to follow my facilitator guide, right? And just that word fail, right? Just
that's
that
great.
Word fail.
Oh,
mate.
Got the eyelid twitching.
I was such a little bitch. Like the response I had was just so defensive and whiny and bordering on unprofessional. Like it wasn't completely career limiting, but it was pathetic. And so 48 hours later, which is way too slow, I asked myself, did that look or feel like something from the past? Yeah, <that's right. laughs> And you know what it was? She reminded me of my mum, right? So this lady reminded me of my mum. And so then she triggered 10-year-old John Anthony, right? So 10-year-old John showed up in response. And so, you know, that's retrospective insight, but it's important, man. You know?
You've just given me a flashback of a saying that my dad would say, prior preparation prevents piss poor performance. And look at this, like, oh, fuck you, I'm going to create a podcast with a friend and we're going to have no preparation whatsoever. Let's just perform, you know.
This is your reaction to it.
That's right.
Peter Parker, pickle peppers. Oh, that's a lot, man.
Yeah, that's how you felt. Wow, yeah.
It's interesting. You know, in the same way that most prezos that you've seen since the 90s, someone gets up and wants to read out the agenda or the learning outcomes, and then they do it, and then they tell you what they did. I remember a couple of years ago, someone said, let me tell you about every prezo you've ever seen. First, someone gets up and starts by telling you how they're going to bore you, then they bore you, and then they end by telling you how they bored you, right? So this harrowing format. But it's not to say that some people don't like it. You know, think about the person that you interviewed. When you said to her in your own way, let's wing it, this person went, no. And so you had to spend 20 minutes unfolding the agenda.
To be fair, I was just, I'm so used to working with you, right? So, to be fair, that was me. Like, would it be nice for us to just like settle into it a little bit? That was all my bad. Hey, you know the sneezing thing? You just reminded me. One of my favorite, like, perverse little hobbies, not hobby, that sounds too cultivated. When I catch someone that's about to sneeze, I love saying bless you or blessing them before the sneeze has happened. And it has this effect where it robs them of the orgasm of the sneeze. And it's such a prickish move, right? So it's like, I'm about to sneeze. I'm like, bless you. And they're like,
This is your new LinkedIn title, Jason Fox, Orgasm Thief.
Yes, that's right.
You just update your LinkedIn for 24 hours. Jason Fox.
My mind went into some pretty whack place of then.
Orgasm thief amidst emergence. Oh, jeepers.
Oh, God.
You rob them of their orgasm. That might be one of my favorite things that you've
said. Maybe that's
the
episode title. Let's
if Jade's listening, that needs to go on the merch. Oh, man. Hey, so Fizzle, I realized that I was supposed to ask you 20 minutes ago, what's on your mind? What's on your mind?
Well, I feel like I should ask you. I feel like I've just dumped, like, all my, the stuff. Like, I am, yeah. No, I've got lots on my mind. I've got one more thing. I'm and then I'm going to ask you what's on your mind. But there's this there's this interesting thing that's happened recently. So as you know, as many folks know, for the past 9 years, but the past 6 years in particular, I've been working on this book. And it's demanding so much of me. It's been nearly 10 years since How to Lead a Quest came out.
Wow, fantastic, man. I love that book. I love that.
Thank you. And yeah, this is just, it's calling me to a kind of a greater intellectual honesty and a kind of like I'm having to like become the person that needs to write this book. Anyway, it's the title is Mythic Mode because I've been so enamored and, you know, since 2019 or 20, or no, it's 2018 I started using the term mythic mode. It came into the Ritual of Becoming. And it's this mode that is quite distinct from the machine mode that people groom themselves for. And it's much more relational, it's more warm data, it's more imaginal, it's more like, it's a different lens that we can put on to kind of enhance. Anyway, a person that I look up to and greatly admire, the author of metarationality.com, meaningness.com, vividness.live, David Chapman. He a couple of weeks ago started a Subsect series about mythic mode.
Ah, okay. So he's got the he's playing with the same term.
He is, and normally my response historically has been like, oh, to be, you know, to go into mythic mode, like to be miffed, and yet this is someone who's not going to do the notion a disservice, and because historically, you know, I've had conversations where I've shared thinking in draft. And others of the kind of the thought leader, even, you know, consultancy types have kind of taken that and ran with it. And I've been like, okay, or like
slightly robbed of your own idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but it's not, this is the thing. It's like you mentioned the word ideas before. The other thing I've come to is like, there is an animacy and some ideas are wanting to be expressed into the world and they'll find vessels. But if you're not working with the muse and letting it come through you, it'll find other ways. And then there's also a sense of like collective genius and the kind of the earth dreaming itself and
the collective unconscious. Like let's
all
go
of
into
that, realm, right? You know? Yeah. Yes. So I'm like attuned to that. And then where I've come to after the initial like, oh no. And then like this grief of like, I don't want to enter rivalrous dynamics around this. I don't want to have like the who's claimed what. And because it's bigger than all of us. But there's this beautiful like, oh, cool. No. This is greatly affirming that others are seeing this too. And we're starting to kind of all be on this team for this. So that was on my mind and now it's just in my heart and I'm feeling more motivated to kind of get this book done.
And legend, so long as what you're not saying is that you're now thinking about changing the title or pivoting or stepping sideways from your original
intent. Those did come to me originally. Yeah, that was kind of like a reaction thing of like, you know, I don't like being unoriginal. But I think I've metabolized that and it's all good. But this is a clumsy segue because you just named it the collective unconsciousness and Jung and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what is on your mind?
Thank you for asking, Legend. I wonder if I've completely rinsed what I was saying to you first. So just to sum up, you're not going to delete your title and you're going to stay on that. I don't want this other person exploring this to somehow diminish the work that you've done, take it away from you or put you into new territory.
No, I don't. Thank you. And I realized, look, I was already deflecting because I realized I subconsciously I've kind of entered into a point where I was squirming. So well done. No, it's not that. But the weird thing is the work, like I had a pop-up newsletter. I've been very kind of in the penumbra with all of this because quite legitimately I don't want that there is a – in the noosphere, the sphere of knowledge, there is a kind of – there's a mimetic ecology and there are, you know – mimetic, like just in any ecology, there are kind of larger creatures that will, you know, we're talking about music before. I saw someone pointing out Taylor Swift's new album and the very uncanny inspiration that they've taken from a bunch of other things that's probably part of the machine optimizing what's like going to be a, and like I just, it's felt like I've needed to protect this. But then at the same time, I don't own it. No one owns it. So there's this weird thing of this surrendered service to something that is larger than ourselves and kind of going what you know, what is going in the direction of enlivenment of, you know, what makes the heart hum and stuff like that. So long story short, no, I'm not. But it was kind of like a hiccup that was required to like get me out of like hermit mode and start to,
well,
and
you know,
to start to maybe play a little bit more in the open. Yeah.
I think this is my instincts, which you can develop. I feel like, in the long run, you're going to be stoked that this has happened. And you might even find yourself referencing some of the stuff that Chapman is talking about now.
Pretty much every newsletter I'm referencing him. Now, here's the uncanny thing. In 2020, when I shared the Substack newsletter back before I left the platform, and now I'm like thinking, oh, shit, do I come back? I mentioned Mythic Mode, and immediately after, I shared an example from David Chapman that I was inspired by. Now, he wasn't calling it Mythic Mode yet, but there's definitely like an alignment going on there. We've just taken very different paths since then, and it's just interesting to notice, like, the because I had this with the first book, The Game Changer. As I was writing that, gamification began to become a buzzword.
That's right.
And I saw it co-opted by consultants that had never played a game in their lives, and just the essence of what makes a game work and hum just being eroded over with the kind of, and I'm just, you know, there's an honoring of some of this stuff that requires it to live in the penumbra. It's kind of the difference between Simon Sinek's infinite game versus the original finite and infinite games. You know, it's like there's a thing we need to kind of, anyway, that's, can't quite put it into words, but.
No, but it's good that we're going there, and I'm glad that you're staying on path, and I think it's going to end up showing up as a bit of a blessing in disguise for you. But of course that's been on your mind, man. That would be on my mind. I'll give you a weird example for that. This is so whack, but I want to tell you how it happened to me. Years ago, when I went down in flames in my marketing career, so I was working at Red Bull and I went down in flames, a very dramatic exit out of that industry. And I ended up working at a friend's bar in Surrey Hills. And I was, you know, I'd never been so poor and happy in my life. Right? I'd gone from this like gangster marketing salary. I had 90 direct reports, proper leadership role. And then next minute, I'm literally popping the top off beer bottles. It didn't even have taps, this pub. I would just stand there, talk to customers, pop the top off caps. But that put me into a really creative period of my life because I had a lot of capacity to dream and live and relax. And I remember telling the bar manager this amazing idea that I had for a film. And essentially what I was saying to him was, it's the same premise as The Wizard of Oz, but rather than everyone being in black and white and then it turns into color, I said it's a silent film and then all of a sudden there's sound.
Ooh.
And within a year, a movie called The Artist came out, and it was exactly my idea, like exactly the same goddamn thing, you know. And that was one of my first windows into the collective unconscious, or, you know. And you had some better language around it, but there is stuff around us all the time, and whether you're open to being a conduit to have it beamed into you or not decides whether or not you're the one that gets to make it manifest. Do you get to be the mouthpiece of the echo of the thing? And so I don't know that it's supposed to be a race. You know, I don't know it's about who gets there first or who did it or branded it first. It's just about whether you want to stay in service of this idea that's greater than you, man, you know. And you're the perfect person to do it. And I would be one of thousands of people who are very excited about your third book. And you do it at your own pace, legend. You do it at your own pace, Fizzle.
Thank you.
Let it emerge, man.
Thank you. Yeah, what's on your mind?
I'll tell you what's been on my mind. Too many things, but this is something I've been looking forward to talking to you about. So I was away with the family on holidays very recently, and we drove up to Queensland and back again. Very ambitious with a five-month-old. Right? The six-year-old was awesome, but my beautiful five-month-old in a car with that many Ks, ambitious. And for anyone who's curious, she was a legend about it, but it was hard. And on the way home, we stopped in Byron for a couple of days, and I went into a bookstore, and I was overwhelmed with how many books I wanted to buy, but I chose one title, and I think it's called Why We Dream. I wish I had it next to me, but I've lost the author, but he's a neuroscientist, and he's got all this research into why we dream, and I'm not even halfway through, but there was something that came through that's definitely worth repeating. Excited to get your brain on it. He said there's three things that have to happen in your brain, your favorite word, Fizzy, Jason, bless you.
Thank you.
I just robbed him of an orgasm. Yes. There's three things that have to happen in order for you to be able to dream. Now, I can't remember all three, but I'll give you the first two. One, your motor neurons need to shut down. So you need to become paralyzed, because if you don't become paralyzed, you start trying to act out your dreams, right? So that makes sense, doesn't it? That needs to shut down. Say again, legend.
What about daydreams?
Well, it's occurred to me that that's why some people do daydream, because their motor neurons don't shut down. So they're up and walking around in their dream, right? So let me rephrase it in order to dream properly, or maybe in order to dream fully. Great, good pickup, right? Mm-hmm. So step one, those neurons have to shut down so that you're paralyzed, so that you're able to actually wander within the new parameters that is your dream. But the second thing that has to happen is your executive system needs to shut down. And this is the part of your mind that's responsible for logic and reason. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about it, these two things have to disappear. Otherwise, you wouldn't embrace these really unlikely narratives that your dreams follow. You know, you'd be talking to your mom, and then all of a sudden it's your mate, and then you walk into a kitchen, and then next minute you're at Disneyland. And so, of course, you go with it when you're dreaming, because your logic and your reason has vanished. You see what's going on here? Mm-hmm. If your logic and reason is with you, you're going to snap yourself out of your dream. You're going to go, hang on, why did mum just turn into JA? And why are we in Disneyland and not in the kitchen anymore? And so this has been kicking around in my noodle a lot. And I'll tell you why, Fizzy. Because I think it plays out in reality. I think sometimes when we share our dreams with people in the waking world, like when you share your intent, when you try to paint your vision, when you lop up an idea, I think sometimes without meaning to, people react with logic and reason and they fuck it up. Mm-hmm. They ruin it. They ruin what it is that's supposed to happen. And I've heard this put in other ways before, but I think I'd like to stop talking and see what you have to say about
it. So we're up to the part two, is it? Or did you say the third part?
No, I'm not sure if I mentioned. I can't remember the third thing. I don't know if I said that. There's three things that have to happen. I've only retained
two
of them.
There's always three things. Yeah, that's cool. Okay. dude, this is the same. Yeah, I'm so with you. This is the logic of the machine as well. This is the modernity cannot tolerate mystery. It wants to colonize it, wants to explain it, wants to box it, wants to categorize it. And so when a baffling dream is shared with all of its potent symbology and what it could mean and what it might not mean, it's like there's a thing that storytellers and bards and folks would have about, like, resisting the temptation to analyze or explain stories, but to instead feed the story and to be with it. And it's a mode that requires us to suspend the rational need to explain and analyze and all that stuff, and to simply kind of be with the potentiality of what has been experienced, right? And that's not a skill that most of us have. And that's not a skill that's not a disposition that society tends to value, but there is so much fruit to be found with, like, staying in the, in the bardo, in the, that dreamlike, what is it? The liminal. Well,
the liminal. And like you said, the potentiality of it, you know, and think about it. Like one of the most fascinating things about dreams is that when you try to hold on to one that's slipping from your memory, the harder you think about it, the quicker it goes. You know, it's fruit from a dying tree. It's really hard. I often find that the harder you grip, the quicker it slips out of your hands. But there's something in that, you know, you just said you're trying to share a dream with someone. And so you're in that possibility space where you're supposed to be talking about what it could mean or what it might mean, but without meaning to, often as people react to it, when they bring in their logic and their reason, they start to rubbish it. They start to put their parameters around it. Their response to it, or their inability to come with you in the dream's infancy, you know, as they start to try to react to it without meaning to, they're snuffing the flame of it. They're snuffing it out. And, I've seen this so many times where people will say, they'll take it one step further and they'll say things that I find quite depressing, like, don't share your goals with people. Don't tell people what it is that you're trying to do. because not everyone is working with you and not everyone is for you. And so sometimes in the process of you doing that, you actually set up malicious intent. There are people around you who know you, who you might have shared it with, who aren't rooting for you. They're not rooting for you. And so in their own way, with their own sort of conscious vibration, they are collapsing the possibility of this thing unfolding for you. I mean, that's intense.
Yeah, I think I would suggest that there's some sensibility to that. I would be selective with whom I share any kind of dreamlike things, although Kim dreams very vividly and keeps a dream journal most days and has a friend who's they exchange dreams with, and they have like Jungian grounding. It's quite generative and enlightening, yeah, and quite insightful. But you know, I think this comes back to a frequency thing. You know, you would attune to someone, and you know, it makes sense to be selective, because most people, their reaction, their allergy to anything that is other than rational, is just too automatic. And you know, it's also the same thing with the goals. Like the fourth way, the Gurdjieff response to it is kind of a bit more sly and detached and a bit like curious and amused. Let's see what happens regarding goals. Like they might be put out there, but it's not the kind of like full on like focused manifestation, because then we're back in the same territory as like, you know, you might miss what is on the sidelines. So, you know, I'm more for directionality rather than destination. Like I have a sense of where I'm moving to. But yeah, I'm careful with the goals and dream expressions. Yeah.
You know, another thing that was occurring to me as you said that as well is,
I would share it with you, by the way. I would feel so comfortable in like 100 private things. Like it's just because I know you'd be able to respond and hold it without collapsing it, and yours would be like a, you know, a kindred spirit would be generative. So sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, but that's because I want it to happen for you as much as you want it to happen for you. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're talking about. You can't be certain. And honestly, man, I think this includes people who love you. So I'll give you another way to slice it. Sometimes you might be speaking to someone who's known you for a very long time, even a family member, someone who's known you forever. But what we sometimes don't consider is when they're talking to you, they're actually talking to a version of you that they have in their head. They're not talking to you now. They're talking to who it is that maybe you were, or if you want to roll real deep, who they decided you were and they didn't even know from the top, right? But what that means is they don't possess the ability to actually come with you on what it is that you're saying. And even though they love you, they don't actually believe in that possibility for you. They can't see it. You know, and what I'm trying to suggest is that even though this might sound pretty fucking out there, Fizzy, you know, I think there's something about that can and might create blockers in reality, in the physical world. And so I guess, you know, one thing that we're both agreeing with in our own way is that there's nothing dangerous about being selective around who you share your dreams with.
Yeah, yeah. And there's this whole thing. I like that thing that there's a version of you, and it's likely that they want to protect that version of you. And so sometimes what you're sharing, you know, might be considered by them to be risky, you know. It's like,
right.
And so they want to keep you safe. But they're the kind of projecting on what safe means for you. It might not actually be what you need. Like there's this thing
the money.
Bill Plotkin's Journey to Soul Initiation and Wild Mind and all this stuff is that when some folks are kind of in a space of dissolution and in the dark forest and in the cocoon and so on, sometimes what you need to actually get you through and to break through a pattern that's been holding you back is a little nonsensical, or it doesn't make sense, or it involves risk or something like that. And most of the trained professionals will kind of talk you out of that just to kind of keep you safe.
Yeah, but, and it's funny because even as you said it, yes, they might be doing it because they think they're keeping you safe, but they're also doing it to keep themselves safe. They're doing it because it lets them remain comfortable. Don't shatter my paradigm, which is my version of you that I have in my mind. You're moving that around now, and that's making me feel unsafe. You know, you're mucking around with my world order. So do it. And sometimes it can come through in a way that's so subtle. You know, I'm even suggesting that they don't know that they're doing it, mate.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But it doesn't mean that it's not happening, and it doesn't mean that it's not having an impact.
It's like the love that for you. You know, it's like they might not even catch when they're saying that, but like the kind of the disapproval is expressed in that in that statement or something. It's like love that for you.
Disapproval and removal. Like you're
removal, sure yeah, that's right. It's like love that for you, but I'm severing. Just yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're severing yourself from the experience, right? So we talk about something like, you know, collective consciousness. You're not, you know, and I know we're sort of going into it now, but even when you sort of rewind science, like aren't they now starting to say that at some point someone has this theory that breaks everything apart and makes it machine-like and mechanical? But what that's done is, even though it sort of started as a theory, people have held onto it as a way to point to the nature of reality. And it's wrong. We're not segregated in that way. Things can't be broken into parts. We're not cogs in a machine or in a system. Mm-hmm. But goddamn, people love to behave as if they are.
Yeah.
And isn't this the nucleus of the glitch?
Yeah, this notion that we are separate to nature and to each other. And the living systems we are of and part of. And talking about hallucinations, so should we dream up a fake ad?
You're getting better and better at the whiskey segues.
I was going to fake ad the segue. Should we dream up the fake ad and then we can land to whiskey? Yeah.
Let's hallucinate to the ad. I don't know why, but this one, I probably need to do a language warning. I didn't mean to, but I feel like there was a bit of profanity in this fake ad.
The language warning dropped so many F-bombs, but yeah.
All right, here's the fake ad, backed by popular demand. Has anyone ever told you that you're a little blunt? Did someone once make you feel like a little runt? Is there the glimmer of a chance that you're just a... Well, here's a technique lifted straight from improv comedy. To soften the blow of any shitfulness that's about to leave your lips. Yes, and. Try saying yes, and in response to the bullshit that people throw at you, including things that couldn't be more outrageously fucked. Listen, everyone, we know there's no I in team, and so I've decided to take all of our work and pitch it as if it were my own. Yes, and. That sounds a bit shitty, Trevor. Guys, I've got some exciting news. On Friday at 4 p.m, pens down, we're doing a Kahoot quiz. Yes, and. I'd rather pour molten lava into my eyeballs. Thanks anyway, Jennifer. Team, I've noticed, and so has senior leadership, that morale has been a little low lately. But if you care to pop into the breakout room, there's a bowl of fruit. You're welcome. Yes, and. How about we consider increasing the workforce and maybe delete this whole 996 insanity? No one's supposed to work for 75 hours, Barry. Yes, and the way forward towards harmony and cohesion. As always, with the non-linear approach, Fizzle hasn't heard the fake ad. But Fizz, it did talk a lot about yes and. It was a tongue-in-cheek spin on yes and.
I love it. I love it. I came across something. I was going to remind me. Jonathan Rosen has been writing these Substack things on ontopoetics, which is a concept that you would really like, ontology, poetics. And brought back in this metamodern thing of it's both and either or.
Yes.
So like when you're holding the thing, it's both and either or. And I'd also say it's also neither nor. So it's both and either or and neither nor. Then we've got the totality of possibility and potentiality.
And you knew I was going to froth on this because now you're going hermetic. And the funniest thing about that is that sometimes you and I get caught up in these conversations where we're so bent on riding the pendulum in both directions that we create and collapse everything that we've said in one conversation.
That's right.
And it's fantastic. Everything expands and collapses. The pendulum must move in both directions, or there is no rhythm.
Yeah, I was thinking about the chariot card in tarot, which then got me to think about, have you seen that, is it Vin Diesel or whoever it is, where he's on the between two trucks doing the splits?
Oh, Van Damme. Van Damme does that.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Doing the thing. I feel like that's us with the both ends sometimes. It's like...
That would be cool animation. You know, it's funny because I'm excited. We're going to do a new cartoon for next year. Actually, that's something I wouldn't mind asking you. Like, do you think next year that we should be calling it Kindred Spirits Season 2? Like, are we going to do that? Are we going to talk about
season? I like that. I actually am warming to the idea of, like, a seasonality. Like, we might take a bit of a break and then come back with a fresh season.
That's it. And maybe we'll tie it into moon cycles or something. It doesn't have to be Gregorian, but we can talk about that. But I just think that's a fun thing to explore. But the main reason why I want to do a season 2 is so we can have a new cartoon. Like, it's just, I'm just amused by that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And this cartoon will be us straddling two trucks. we got to stay mystical. Now, Legend, speaking of mystical, shall we mystically crack the top of today's edition?
Yes. All I know is it's got a yellow sticker.
Outstanding. Well, I'm thrilled to share that this is one that I've been sitting on for ages, but I deliberately opened when you were here. So you might remember you were here and I sent you home with four to match the four that you'd brought to me, but I only had three open, so I had to crack this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That's exciting.
And so it's my pleasure to bring onto the screen and into our listeners' ear holes the Glendronach 18 Allardyce. Man. Oloroso for days. I mean, this is... anyone who hasn't heard of the distillery, Glendronach, it's probably one of my favorites. They're known for their sherry bombs. It's easily one of my favorite distilleries, mate. And this
one's
the color
is beautiful.
Oh, look at it. I mean, it's like Coca-Cola. In fact, I would go as far as saying it's even darker than Coca-Cola. What do you think, Fizz? I think it's even darker than Coca-Cola, which is pretty dark whiskey. Or exclusively Oloroso, which is a beautiful sherry cask. And this one's aged 18 years at least. So the way it works with Glendronach, they've got these weird charts with sliding scales where you can often look up the batch number. And so you can go, or even though I'm holding on to an inverted commas 18-year-old, this one's actually 24 years old. There's this weird chart that you can find. It's called Allardyce or Allardyce, named after James Allardyce or Allardyce, who's the OG distiller, the guy who created it back in 1826. And it's one of my favorite sherry bombs, man. You know, we should probably share with our listeners that historically, the Jay Fizzle hasn't been a big fan of sherry whiskeys. Talk us through it, Jay.
That's just the super Christmassy vibes. But that, you know, maybe I'm okay. Maybe this is an old story of mine because there's a lot that can surface. But sherry, yeah, down for. I'm actually quite fond of sherry itself. My nana enjoyed a sherry.
So did mine.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
You know, it's funny you said that because my nana, my beautiful, we used to call her Adi. She was obsessed with sherry as well. She used to have her mates over for cards and they'd sit around playing cards and drinking sherry. So cute. Yeah. So cute. Yeah. But sadly, especially for someone like me who's obsessed with sherry whiskeys, people aren't drinking it anymore. Sherry, it's a dying thing. And so what's happening amusingly globally is there are some places who are producing sherry purely so they can create the casks so that those casks can then be on-sold to create whiskey. So this is an issue with sherry broadly, globally, and it's pushing up the price point for sherry casks, whiskeys. It's
interesting.
A
I'm seeing there's so many more distilleries popping up, and I feel like this is the result of like – whiskey becoming popular again in the early 2000s.
Yes.
And then, so, the, you know, so they're all coming online now. But I'm like, oh, sometimes they just, you can see like there's like VC money or something behind this. Like everything's a little bit too polished. And I'm like trying to find like what's the, because the thing, the good thing about Glenn Dronach is like there's, you know, a lot of Scottish distilleries, like there's history and stuff like that there.
So much history.
Yeah, for the new players on the scene, I kind of want them to just dig deeper into the soil of what is authentic for them. Like they're, you know, rather than just,
you're right, brother. And then the other thing we don't have is a time machine, because if we could push forward 200 years, then we'd be in a much better spot with these emerging distilleries.
That's right.
You know, one of the things that I find so sad is because of what you described happening in 2000 and whiskey popping off and becoming en vogue and now really big to a younger generation, it has ruined the price point on Japanese whiskey. Like, have you seen what's happened? Japanese whiskey, right? It's over. You can't, you know, if you want a decent Japanese whiskey, no one can afford it. But how could they have possibly planned for the demand? And that's what we're talking about.
Some of the stuff I used to just mix for a highball or something like that in the past. Look at it now. And I actually think that maybe whiskey would have been better investment than crypto.
I know, man. There's a website called Denkata, and that's all about Japanese whiskies. I want to make sure I'm spelling it right. And I had to unsubscribe from Denkata because the average price point was like $4,000. Like, they're like, oh, here's this month's release. And you're looking at this website going, like, who can afford a Hibiki 21 anymore? Like, those,
I had one of those bottles once. They were great. It was a beautiful bottle.
Even whiskeys like Yamazaki.
Yeah, we all did. That's right.
I'm trying to find a price right here. I mean, let me just do it while I got you here. How much is Hibiki 21? Let's see what the false...
I actually worked with Beam and Suntory and Beam when they merged together, and with the executive team there, and I got given a Hibiki 21.
Damn.
When I was working with them in the Hunter Valley.
So there it is, Fizz. So 21, $1,200 a bottle for the Hibiki 21, and then if you want the 30, that's 14 grand for one bottle. This is what's happened to Japanese whiskey. It's now out of our reach, which is just heartbreaking. Anyway, weird side quest. Let's go back to what we're doing. So are you ready for the pop legend?
Yeah, man. Let's hear it.
Okay. Here we go.
Oh,
is that any good?
That was like the twist, the pop, and a bit of slosh.
Yes, I was really hoping that you got the slosh, because I was about to say it was a pop and slosh, right? And now my remarkable is garnished with whiskey.
Oh, good. Yeah, it was very kind of like.
Oh my! Who could have thought we could add to the twist and plop? It's now the twist, pop, and slosh. Here's the cup. It's the twist, pop, slosh, and now the glub.
Oh, you know how to do it. That was great.
I regret not pouring more, but that's not to stop me from.
All right, now I'll do my little. Okay, here we go. Oh, shit. It's like being
you're
in the
squeezing
stalls.
From the teat. This is what happened in episode one. We don't
I've
squeeze
never
from
done
the teat.
This
no, Fizz, you've got to screw the lid. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, man.
You're always sending him to me. I get it. It's the first time you've
first
actually
time.
Used your own vessel.
Great.
That was magnificent. That was so
Oh,
good.
Wow.
Oh, that was fantastic.
Already I can smell. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, mate. Straight to the nose. Instant sultanas. Maraschino cherries. Dried apricots. God damn.
It's like slow cooked in a kind of butter or something. There's caramelization.
Yeah, like an apricot pie or something, Fizz. You got that buttery.
Yeah.
That buttery.
Oh, yeah. So, but there's like the kind of really buttery puff pastry as well going on with this. Definitely sultanas and apricot. Yeah. I mean, I always feel like the marzipan tasting note is just, sorry, the nose note is. It's just like in the initial things, like, you know, what I find. Like, I find that marzipan, if I give it a little bit more, it's.
It doesn't linger. Orange peel, Fizz.
Yeah, and you know, this is the point here, what I'm liking about this. It's orange peel or orange, zest, but it's not dried orange rind.
That's right.
The hard, chunky bits that you get in a kind of Christmas pudding.
And it's funny because some of the really good Glendronach single cast that I've had, I often get marmalade, and so that's where you're saying, anything that's kind of bitter or tart or violent about the orange zest is taken out, and all you're enjoying is that kind of more creamy, orangey, sugary, syrupy orange.
Exactly, exactly.
Oh, man, that's one of my favorite. Yeah,
biscuit is so good. It's so good, man.
That's a favorite nosing from season one. Okay, are you going there?
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Jason, did you bring this bit jello?
I think it's nearby one.
I don't know if we mentioned to our listeners, I gave Jason a spit chalice of his very own when he was here about a month ago. And it's a completely ridiculous, redundant, unnecessary vessel. I don't even remember how we use it. We certainly don't spit into it. What do we do with it again, Fizz? This is my ridiculous idea.
I don't know where it is.
Oh, you've like misplaced your spit chalice.
It's somewhere. Oh, I'm so sorry. Who was the friend who made it?
PC, my brother-in-law, PC. Shout out, PC.
Nice. Thanks, PC.
3D printing spit chalice for us.
Yes.
Doing the spit trick now. Anyone listening for the first time, this is a technique that Jason taught me where you start before tasting by putting just as much whiskey as there is saliva in your mouth to essentially coat the lining of your tongue and mouth before taking your first actual sip of the whiskey.
Yeah, I really like the cupping of the tongue to the roof of the mouth allows the alcohol to kind of diffuse. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then by the time you swallow, it just glides down the gullet and it's all smooth. But then it kind of like, instead of the throat having the shock of the alcohol, it's like, okay, all right, know what's going on here.
Yeah, it's the opposite to robbing yourself of an orgasm. Here we go. You know what happened just then? Pecan pie. Pecan. And I don't... Yeah, I suppose people get nut notes from Oloroso, but I just went pecan pie.
Yeah, it's amazing the power of, like, as soon as you evoke the word, and of course I'm experiencing it, it's... They're definitely pecans. Oh, but it's like... There's some sort of carry with the sultana, the deep kind of...
prunes,
like something slow roasted, slow stewed or roasted prunes, like dates. It's like got that.
When you said roasted, I started going to walnut, but I'm not going to describe it as a nutty whiskey. I just went pecan pie first up. Do you get the dark chocolate finish, Fizz? Like, it's got a long finish on it, but it goes for me a really nice, like, 75% cocoa chocolate block at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And the thing I'd say this is one of the best whiskeys I've ever had.
Yes, man. I really hoped that I was going to bring you out of your weird, I don't like sherry bombs thing. It just didn't make any sense to me. Yes.
What I'm loving about this is there's no overpowering sweetness. It's like, there's a sweetness there. It's not salty like one of the ones I've snuck in things, it's going to have that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there is a bit of saltedness there, but it's not anywhere overpowering. But there's this carry of the roasted or the stewed sultanas and prunes and dates and so on, and in that, and it's the other thing too, it's not overpowering the spices. Like some things get way too carried away with the cinnamon and stuff like
that's right, it's not going that's all not carried away cinnamon.
And it's just such a vehicle for like these complex mix, so there is the hint of nut there, but none of it's standing out. But that doesn't mean it's not mediocre. It's like there's so much going on in
mate.
Really nuanced and subtle way. It's like far out. It's like, I want to get to...
You know what it is? You know what it is, Fizz? It's the balance. The balance.
So beautifully balanced.
Is astounding. And, you know, what it lets me do is talk about an elusive unicorn in the world of whiskey, the original Glendronach 15 Revival. Okay, so anyone who knows whiskey knows what I'm talking about. Their old distiller, this guy named Billy Walker, he bashed out this 15 Revival years ago now, and it had a really reasonable price point, and it was one of the best whiskeys on the planet. And ever since he's left, they haven't been able to recreate it the same, right? So it's become this unicorn whiskey. If you can find a Glendronach 15 by Billy Walker, they hardly don't exist anymore. They're almost gone. And Rachel Barry, who's replaced him, she does a 15, and it's also called the Revival, and it's a decent whiskey, but it's not what Billy had done. And the only way that I can describe why the Billy Walker one is superior is because of the balance, Fizz. The balance of this whiskey is insane. It almost feels like you're smoking an expensive cigar. That's sort of the sensation you have of how well balanced it is.
Yeah. It's like, you know, coffee roasters will mix the beans and the roasting temperatures sometimes to create like the perfect mix. And distillers will be going there with their things and just kind of working out what's the thing. It is so beautifully distilled. I just thought experiment. What happens if like there was a 15-year-old bottle, the Billy Walker one surfaces, and people are like, you know what, we're going to do there's, you know, however many 60-mil pours, like 230-mil pours. Mm. It's going to be like auction, or then you know, get your tickets and so on like that. Mm. It'd be worth having a bit of a bid and then just flying over to just sit and have a couple of, you know, couple of 30 mil things. And I like the ridiculousness of that, like traveling to have two 30 mil drams.
We will get ourselves mixed up in some ridiculous. One of my favorite ridiculous was when Bowmore did Double the Devil. I don't know if I've ever told you about this, but this is a unicorn whiskey where they went, it's called Double the Devil because they weren't first Jimenez and then Oloroso. So they jumped between two sherry casks. So it's a doublesherrybomb.com whiskey. Bowmore Double the Devil, gone. You can't find it. And my friend Talas found it in a whiskey bar in Kyoto. And Fizzle, I went to Kyoto and drank it.
Oh, wow. Wow. You know,
and this type of thing is always, it often gets clouded, not clouded, but maybe bamboozled or mixed up in the experience. You know, it's like when you have a great red wine, you realize, oh, that was the restaurant, that it wasn't the red, or the restaurant played a part. But man, like, I love that idea of you and I chasing some unicorn somewhere, man. That's more of a when than an if.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. I poured out some more of this, try to get like a few more drops from this thing. That is great. Wow, that's two of my favoritest whiskeys. That and the kind of crazy one, the bonkers one.
Oh, that's right. Delightfully like, bonkers. Good.
Yeah, that was like, not that I'd pit that as like a favorite, but it was such a unique experience. Like, I was so glad for it.
So whack. I think, I'll be honest, I'm going to call it, I think I started with my strongest of the four just then. So just brace for it.
That's cool. No, that's great, man.
As we do the others. Outstanding. Well, mate, are we arriving on the precipice of some bad advice? Where are we, my good man?
I think we are. This is so good. And I'm so excited that I'm going to be seeing you in the flesh very soon, and we're going to be having some whiskeys in real life.
Mate, can't wait. Cannot wait.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I was just about to say, this is the first time we've done day drinking as we drink whiskey at midday for the recording. God. The only thing I'm worried about when we party at that Abbey event in November is stamina. Like, what are we going to do, man?
Yeah, we'll stay hydrated. We'll go for walks. We'll, you know, have meal breaks. We'll be all right. That's what I say.
And there's this really cool emerging maneuver where you drink Korean pear juice. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen this.
So you drink Korean pear juice right before you go out on the lash, and then you drink it again when you get home that evening and you wake up sans hangover. Mate.
Okay.
I simply insist that we find some Korean. Okay, before we get into it. Too good. All right, so I'll start. when you have a dream, share it. Share your dream far and wide, including with people who clearly don't want the best for you. Share your dreams with your nemesis.
Yeah, and have them explain it to you.
help them to decipher your dream, or go out of your way to use their reason and logic to dissolve the dream before it unfolds. Mm.
Let people know that you're just putting the best stuff in the podcast up front. No need to warm up your guests or any, you know, fluff. That way they know that after 5 minutes they can stop listening.
Cut to the footnotes. Take yourself really seriously. Make sure you're constantly serious. If you're meeting an audience for the first time, don't let your guard down. You know, avoid anything that sees you poking fun at you. Crystallize yourself as an authority from the top, and stay on that frequency.
Crystallize. Yeah, don't change. Be like a rock. You know. Just be careful, because there's people out there that'll steal your ideas. So if you've been thinking about something, but someone else actually then does it, they've stolen your IP. That is your intellectual property, and you need to get the lawyers onto them stat.
If you hear someone start to play around in similar territory that you've been exploring, or even worse, use the exact terminology that was about to be the title of your upcoming book, cancel the book, cancel all the work you've done, cancel your research, cancel all of your ideas, and try to come up with something else.
Yeah, yeah, it's not worth it.
And be angry at them. Be angry at them for having similar clever ideas.
That's right. To you. God.
It's not either or. It's not neither nor. It's just one thing.
Oh, that's right.
What it is. Yeah, out what the one thing is.
Yeah. You must be hyper-rational. It's not enough to be rational. You need to be hyper-rational. Cultivate an allergy to anything that is ambiguous. Force categorization. Nothing can be both and nor either, or it must be just the one thing. Yeah. I think I just repeated your one.
Sorry. Healthy. No, it's good. We're doing jazz. We're doing jazz. Jazz, baby. See, I often think that I'm cheating, because I scribble down stuff that you say onto my Remarkable, whereas you just find some weird way to retain the whole episode in your head.
Oh, that's cool. I did write down Robbed Orgasm.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's going to be the title of this episode.
Yeah, yeah. I just, you know, that's weird, the thing. I just have this image of, like, two people in coitus, and they're about to like change position, and then one of us, or I come in there, finish off the guy with a hand job just quick, and then robbed.
You just robbed. He's been robbed of the orgasm he'd rather have.
Not again, Jason.
Here he is again. The orgasm orgasm robber. Jason often appears at the window. There he is, rapping on the window, rapping on the window again to rob me of my orgasm.
Good.
Can I ask a question? Like, does the orgasm robber wear a cape?
Of course.
Are you supposed to be incognito? Because now everyone knows who you are, Peter Parker, orgasm robber. Hey, Bruce Banner, everyone knows that you turn into the orgasm robber.
Reminds me of this SNBC comic. Have you seen SNBC comics?
No.
It's a web comic, been running for a while. It's like, it starts as a scene like, girl saying to the guy, no, I don't want to, no, don't say it. It's not a superpower. And he's like pouting. It's like, and she's like, okay, fine. And he's like, are you okay? I came as fast as I could. It's like, never mind. There I am again.
Well done, sir.
Bringing it in.
That's classic orgasm robber banter.
Anyway, I don't know about this guy. They just heard about him.
Oh man,
I have immediate regret bringing that whole thing. But that's how
I'm really enjoying. I'm really enjoying that image now of like you at the window with mal intent. and you show up right as they're arriving.
I'm not there yet. Honestly, I'm not there yet. I'm just rubbing people's sneezes. That's all I do. It's like, well, one day, though. One day.
It's a gateway. It's like psychopaths that start by killing animals. That's right. Yeah, that's you're on the trajectory, Fitz.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
It started innocently with sneezing.
I tell you, when you come here, the plane trees have been ridiculous with the winds and everything like that. You might find yourself sneezing, and I look forward to denying
it. There's a good chance, man, because I've got asthma as well, so I've got to strap in.
Yeah, you're in. And whiskey's an antihistamine too. Sorry, not it's a histamine. Yeah, so.
Ah, there you go. Double deuce.
Yeah.
Expect to be robbed. Okay. All right, legend. Always a pleasure, mate. I'm thrilled that I'm edging you around.
Aren't we supposed to do actually, like, I didn't want to end on that note. We're supposed to reflect on some good stuff, right?
Oh, good. No, we're about to end the whole thing with bad advice.
Seriously, okay, I do want to just... you have the sensibility of knowing how to show up as a friend, and I really appreciate how you held me there. And yeah, with regards to the book and such a solo isolating journey and stuff like that, it's nice. It's like I wish for everyone to have a kindred spirit and at least one, someone who has your back, someone that you can turn to when you're like not sure what to do. I'm lucky that I have a small handful of a few, of which I'm very grateful to consider you to be one of them, John Anthony.
Thank you, my friend. And this might sound weird, but you probably don't realize how many people are proud of you, man. You know, like people are proud of you, and people are lucky to know you, and they're impressed by you, and they will patiently wait for you to punch out this third book at whatever pace suits you. Or let me spin that differently, at whatever pace suits the best version of the book. And maybe that's why you're moving at a pace that you're finding frustrating. It's because you're not going to fart this thing out, man. Like, you're going to do it properly in a way that feels measured, so that you put putting your best foot forward, you know. So people are happy to wait, mates, you know. What do I want to say to you? Oh yeah, so this might feel like a funny side story, but it helps to tie in what we're saying. Just this morning, my beautiful daughter Phoenix, who's 6, said to me, "Dad, where's the record that you gave me?" Right? And I didn't know what she meant. I couldn't remember what she meant. And then I realized she was asking for John Song, which is my solo artist name, vinyl that I produced a few years ago. And when I went and found it for her, she was so happy to get her hands on it. And she said, "Dad, can we put this on, please?" But when I dropped the needle on my own record and just got to enjoy watching my daughter sit in front of the speaker and enjoy my music, the first thought that came into my head was, "Oh yeah, John, you're not a piece of shit." Right. You're not a piece of shit. And that was the first moment that I realized for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been thinking of myself as a piece of shit. Right. And you know, I'm not happy that that's happened, but I'm happy with the realization. And I guess I'm trying to say that to you, man, because, you know, I don't think that anyone holds on to a version of themselves in their mind 24/7 where you view yourself purely as a rock star, you know? And so you're allowed to slip and stumble and doubt yourself and get weird. And sometimes, you know, it's your kindred spirits and your family and the people who are closest to you that have the ability to remind you of your own awesome, you know? And that's a reason to cultivate and nourish that web around yourself.
And it's making me think, thank you. And it's also like the hermetic quality of good friendship. When someone is getting a bit too carried away and they're getting a bit full of themselves, the duty of a friend is to hang shit on them so that they are reminded that they're not. So we've got to kind of keep it in balance, right? So
if you need that, just go and speak to one of your parents. Oh, my God.
Oh, mate. Always a pleasure. Yeah.
So fun, my friend. Lots of love. Shall I edge towards the drum pad?
Yeah, let's just shout out to the folks listening. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you. We get your notes. We love your support. Thank you for listening.
This has been Ruined Orgasm. Did we just rename the podcast?